FOIA benefits and administrative committees.
Good morning, Your Honor. Barry Schultz on behalf of the plaintiff, Ramesh Garg. In this case, Your Honors, the final decisions of the plan administrator for the disability benefits plan for a Square D company, both for short-term disability and for long-term disability benefits, the decision stated that, quote, regardless of Mr. Garg's ability to meet the criteria of disability, close quote, because he continued to work full-time, he wasn't eligible for those benefits. Almost based on that language alone, plaintiff would request that this court find that decision to be unreasonable and arbitrary and capricious because it's exactly the criteria for disability that the plan administrator was required to consider and make its determination on in this case. Not regardless of that criteria, but specifically the criteria set forth in the plan.
Was the plan required to determine the disability of employees who are working if they make no claim of disability? That seems to be a rather onerous duty to impose on a plan, isn't it?
In fact, the plan itself allows an employee or a claimant to submit a claim for benefits up to 1 year after they last worked. There's no requirement in the plan that an employee have notified the...
Well, that's another issue, I think, and it seems to be a rather... I think the trial judge here determined that was not the case, didn't she? What she just stated?
Well, what she really stated was that she found that the determination wasn't arbitrary and capricious because of the fact that he worked full-time, he didn't notify his supervisor of his disability, and he didn't miss work. But I think the question should be, and it's uncontradicted on this record, that Mr. Garg was disabled, was unable to perform his job responsibilities. There's medical evidence and medical opinions.
Didn't he only have coverage up until the last day of his employment?
He only had coverage, that's right. And so
he wasn't under an approved rehab program either, was he? And aren't those two of the qualifications?
No, I think the defendants actually err in their interpretation of the plan because for long-term disability benefits, it says the claimants are not eligible if they are working at that time, unless they're working under a plan. But at the time, Mr. Garg would have been...
He was no longer an employee.
But if he became... But even the defendant agrees, and the plan administrator in its decision agree, that if Mr. Garg was disabled before he was terminated from his job, then he was covered. So the question of coverage goes to the issue of when he became disabled. Otherwise, if the plan administrator here is allowed to deny benefits in this case, then an employer can actually...
Isn't this the language from the contract? Additionally, with respect to long-term disability, only a person who was gainfully employed at the time of the alleged onset may collect benefits unless he's working under an approved rehabilitation program. That's referred to as the rehabilitation clause.
What the plan says that an employee who is gainfully employed is not eligible for long-term disability benefits unless working under an approved rehabilitation plan. But at the time that Mr. Garg was eligible or would have been eligible to receive long-term disability
would
benefits...
Would have been, now we're at...
He was not working.
Sure,
that's right.
He was no longer an employee. He had lost his benefits.
Well, but if he was disabled prior to the time that he was terminated from his job, then he was covered for these benefits. Otherwise, you give the employer...
He wasn't disabled if he was working full-time.
Well, no, I believe that's the issue in this case. The employer fired Mr. Garg because he was unable to perform his job. He was working at 50% capacity. though he was not capable of performing the responsibilities of his job, and the employer decided that by firing him. So what the position Mr. Garg was put in is that he wanted to work, and he was trying to work desperately. He was working overtime trying to make his production quota.
Well, did the employer do anything that was improper or illegal here?
No, but that's not the issue. They absolutely had the right to fire Mr. Garg, but the plant administrator did something
else. And his employment was properly terminated, right?
His employment was properly terminated. But if he was disabled before he was...
At that point in time, then can he make a disability claim?
Yes, absolutely. Under the terms of this plan, he can, if he was unable to perform his job responsibilities. Otherwise, anybody who's trying to work, who has a recognized impairment, could be denied disability benefits by being fired. Anybody who has...
I'm not sure what's wrong with that. That's just a different way of putting the point that this plan tries to get employees to bring disabilities to the attention of the employer so they can be accommodated, rather than, say, allowing your work performance to run down, causing the employer problems in its business, and only then, when it's too late, saying, oh, whoops, I was disabled. Isn't it an entirely appropriate thing to do to give employees incentives to bring their problems to the attention of the employer soon rather than only after they get fired?
I don't think there's any problem with that other than, and there's no problem with that, but the plan in this case doesn't require any kind of notice whatsoever.
It creates the incentive by saying that if you wait and get fired, it's too late to claim you were disabled.
Well, the plan actually doesn't say that because it says you can submit a claim up to 1 year after you were last actively at work. So what would that ability to submit a claim 1 year later would have no meaning if you're terminated from your job, then you can't get benefits. A person, I think that part of the plan actually suggests that the plan administrator allowed these types of claims. Otherwise, what would be the meaning of allowing a claimant to submit a claim a year after they're actively at work while saying, but if we fire you at any time, when you don't know when you might be fired, you're not eligible for these benefits. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Nancy Ross on behalf of the Square D Plan Administrator. What my colleague fails to realize here is that the standard is not whether the Plan Administrator's decision was wrong. It's not whether it was mistaken. It's whether it was reasonable in light of the plan language and the evidence before the Plan Administrator. My colleague spends an awful lot of time emphasizing the language in the plan that says that an employee can file a claim within 1 year of actively working, which should allow his client to be able to file a claim after he was terminated. It simply is not reasonable to interpret that language, which includes the term employee, which is a defined term under the plan that includes someone working full-time or part-time 17 and a half hours, and also includes the term actively working. My colleague's client was no longer an employee. He had been terminated, and he was not actively working at the time he filed the claim.
What's the plan language again?
The plan language that my colleague relies on is that which says that an employee can file a claim within 1 year of actively working. Now, I think the more reasonable interpretation of that is that that provides a situation where an employee goes home in the evening, an employee has a heart attack, an employee is no longer actively working because he's in the hospital. His claim is not barred simply because he didn't file it in less than, you know, a month, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months.
Why doesn't it literally cover this situation, though?
Because here, Mr. Garg was no longer an employee. He was terminated. An employee is defined under the plan as one who is either working full-time or working part-time.
Well, doesn't it, when you're talking about an employee who is no longer actively working, doesn't that suggest someone who used to be an employee?
No, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with that interpretation, because I believe the term actively working, the term actively qualifies working. So you have two considerations. One, to require that it's an employee, and two, it's one who cannot be actively working. I think the
So you're saying that Wally in the Dilbert comic strip would not be an employee. He may be working, but not actively.
I think that that's one possible interpretation. Most importantly, Your Honors, this argument was never even made to the plan administrator. This was a newly constructed argument that the plaintiff developed at the time that we were in front of the district court. So the plan administrator has never espoused on how the plan administrator would interpret this language. Let's take a look at some of the evidence here. We've got a guy who, for his entire year and a half at Square D, never misses a day due to illness, never complains of his illness, never talks about seeing a doctor until the day he's fired, when his wife calls at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and says, gee, we'd like to file a claim. Mr. Garg received two performance warnings. They devised a performance plan for him on October 16, 1998. They said, you're not performing well. He continued to try to meet the performance plan. He was warned that if he didn't, it could lead to discipline up to and including termination. 2 weeks later, on October 30th, he's warned again that he hasn't met the performance plan that they have created for him. On the morning of his termination, he sends a memo to his supervisors, and he asks for an extension. And he says that the reason that he cannot meet the performance program that was set up for him is not due to any health problems, mind you, but rather it's due to the computer system at Square D.
He specifically said it wasn't due to any health problems?
No. What he said is it's due to Square D. He said it by way of silence, Your Honor.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yes. He says, if you give me more time, I believe, quote unquote, I believe I can meet or even exceed the performance standards that you set.
He was a pretty good employee. He just wanted to keep his job in any way that he can. Can it be interpreted that way?
Perhaps that's right, Your Honor, but the fact of the matter is, on the evidence in front of the plan administrator, there was no evidence that during the time this man was employed, he was disabled.
Have you, as your firm at any time, given an employee these benefits under circumstances similar to this, that he did not report it until he was terminated, but the events took place or the illness took place while he was employed?
I presume, Your Honor, when you said your firm, you mean my client?
Your client, right.
Yes. No, my client has not. This was uniform with their practice.
And they have never done it before?
To my knowledge, they had not done this before. Primarily because the first reason and primary reason for the committee, the Employee Benefits Administrative Committee, was that they interpret the plan, which says coverage ends when you end your employment, to mean that once you are gone, you are no longer covered. I do not believe that they have faced a situation where somebody is disabled earlier on in their career and there's evidence about it, and they have to go back and perhaps should determine whether or not their performance was due to health problems, which then led to their termination. And in fact, Your Honor, that was the situation in Perlman, and that is the case that the plaintiff relies very heavily on here, and that is, as Judge Easterbrook knows, the very difference with Perlman. In Perlman, the plaintiff had a history of medical problems. In fact, she had two previous leave of absence. And in Perlman, the court upheld the denial of benefits. What the court said is, had she been terminated, it probably would have been prudent to look to see if she had been terminated because of poor performance, which was tied to her prior disabilities.
How is the concept that this claim could not be brought because the employee was no longer covered, how can that be squared with the provision from the plan that you read a little earlier, that you can bring a claim within 1 year of ceasing to be an active worker.
But that's not what it says, Your Honor. It says an employee may bring a claim within 1 year from actively working. And as I explained previously, I think the best example of that is something that my clients, plan administrators, allow all the time, which is if somebody is incapacitated or somebody's dependent is incapacitated and they can't file the claim for 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, that's strictly a limitations period for when the claim has to be filed, but the person is still covered under the plan.
But the concept of coverage really applies to the circumstances which might give rise to liability, not to the point in time when the claim is brought.
Well, I think that's right, and the fact of the matter is the plaintiff in this case, one of the interesting things also about the evidence here is they seem to be all over the map, because the plaintiff argues in his brief that, you know, he's not claiming that his client was disabled until November 30th, 1998, which was the very last day, all right? Well, if the plaintiff became disabled as of 11/30/98, when he was no longer an employee, undisputably, then he's not covered under the plan.
Didn't the doctors say that this illness or these illnesses that he had contributed to his not being able to perform properly?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Your Honor,
because
the doctor's reports are one of the more interesting.
Can you answer that, yes or no?
His primary doctor did. His optometrist, I think, said it in a bit of a more ambiguous manner. But the doctor reports, there were no contemporaneous doctor reports. The doctor reports came into existence in January of 1999. There were no doctor reports submitted during the time that he was an employee.
Couldn't the doctor look at his records of treatment and use those as they are normally introduced in court as his own records?
Certainly, Your Honor, but that's not what his doctors did. In fact, one of the more interesting things is neither of the two doctor reports that Mr. Garg submitted to the plan administrator had any date stated for the onset of his disability. And in fact, it was not until Mr. Garg went through the second stage of the LTD appeal in 2000 that both doctors submitted a second report, very short, couple sentences, that said everything that I said about Mr. Garg in my previous report was in existence a few months prior to his leaving on November
30th. Well, do you give any guidelines to your, or does your client give any guidelines to the employees to what they must file when they are making an application for a disability benefit?
Oh, certainly, Your Honor.
And that's in there.
Yeah, it's a multi-page form.
I know,
form.
But does it say this, that you must give the onset date of it?
It asks specifically what's the onset date for disability.
And that wasn't filled in.
He filled it in. The plaintiff filled it in to say November 30th, 1998.
Okay.
And the doctor, at the same time the plaintiff filled that in, on the exact same date, said that the disability began June 15, 1998. Therefore, my last comment, if in fact he was disabled as of June 15, 1998, like his one doctor said, then he was gainfully employed, and then he had to be working under a rehabilitation program approved by Square D in order to be deemed totally disabled under the plan. And there's no dispute that he was not. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
As to the question of filing the claim within 1 year, it's found at page D476 of the record, and my review of it shows it doesn't say anything about an employee. It says claims for disability benefits and supporting medical evidence must be submitted within 1 year from the last date you were actively at work. It doesn't say anything about only employees. Plan administrator in this case did not question the medical evidence. Plan administrator could have had a doctor review the records or ask Mr. Garg for more information, but they didn't dispute at any time his doctor's opinion that he was disabled. They only found him not disabled. The only reason was because he was working full-time. And the fact that he was working does not establish that he was able to perform his job responsibility. And on this job, the employer said, you couldn't perform your job responsibilities, and therefore you're fired because you were only working at 50% capacity. And they knew that he was working overtime, trying to work, trying to get his work done. He still could only get 50% of his work done, and then they fired him. They knew that he couldn't perform his work. So then, under the Perlman decision, I believe the only question for the plan administrator was, what was the reason for Mr. Garg's poor work performance? And on this record, it's uncontested that the reason for his poor work performance was his medical condition. And he had many...
You're saying it's not relevant that he was not covered at the time that he made the claim.
That's correct. And I think the defendants acknowledged that in their response to plaintiff's 56.1 state rule 56.1 statement of fact, and additionally the plan administrator states that in one of their decisions that the question was whether he was disabled while he was covered, and the medical evidence in this case shows that he was. That's uncontradicted. The plan administrator never questioned
that. Judge Pallmeyer seems to have given considerable weight to the fact that he wasn't covered after he left the job. So what was presented to her? Her conclusion.
It was basically the same arguments that were presented here, Your Honor. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. Court will take the